This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk.
Hello and welcome to L&G Talks Asset Management. My name is Harry Brooks. I'm head of client editorial. And today I'm joined by Ben Bennett, our chief investment strategist, Asia, to discuss the big ideas that are shaping markets. Ben, it's the first week of September and summer is already starting to feel like a distant memory for some. For the benefit of listeners who spent August on holiday and away from their screens, what have they missed?
I think we're going to talk about an awful lot of it, aren't we? And it's higher bond yields, it's sticky inflation still, but yeah, resilient equity and credit markets, which is still ongoing. Plus, my baby just turned 7 weeks, so that's what I've been focusing on over the summer.
Congratulations. I'm glad to hear your priorities are in the right place.
Yeah.
The global bond sell-off from August deepened this week. We're speaking, of course, on Tuesday, the 2nd of September. I think UK borrowing costs are now at their highest level since the global financial crisis back in 2008. And Japan's 10-year bonds topped 3%, which is a level that hasn't been seen for 30 years. So I've got two questions for you off the back of that. Firstly, how are higher long-end yields shaping cross-asset performance? And secondly, given there are a number of big central bank decisions coming up over September, are policymakers becoming more concerned about inflation persistence, or are they more concerned about slowing growth?
Well, the second question first is policymakers seem to be getting more concerned about the inflation, the sticky inflation prints. And that's not just what's going on in commodity markets. I think we should dig into that a little bit later. But, you know, still we've got elevated energy prices and some parts of the energy space are getting worse, if anything. But it's also this massive investment in AI that's driving prices and driving activity higher in that sector, which, as policymakers, I think it's fair to worry that that ultimately will feed into other parts of the economy and could keep prices more broadly higher. So underlying all that, do you remember like this time last year, we were starting to get a bit worried about job growth in the US and there was actually rate cuts priced in at the beginning of this year because maybe central bankers, had to think about that downside risk. Well, that's still a little bit of concern about bits of the economy, but broadly, I'd say that downside risk has gone away. Growth is fine. That's the best way I could probably describe it. So from a growth perspective, from a earnings perspective, which is really strong, that's all going okay. So it really is about the inflation, the sticky inflation that is concerning central bankers. We heard from Kevin Warsh, the still relatively new Fed chair on Friday. He spoke at his first Jackson Hole symposium and he basically laid this out. He said, look, I need to see inflation falling down to target sort of right now. Otherwise, we're going to hike. I sort of paraphrase, but that's basically what he said. And that's at least what investors, market participants have taken away from what he said. There's now a 2/3 chance for a rate hike by the Fed in September, in their September meeting, which is on the 16th of September. And there's nearly two 25 basis point hikes priced in before the end of the year. So yeah, that's really the focus. And that's really driving everything around central banks right now.
So we'll know a bit more in a couple of weeks' time when the Fed next meet. Earlier this week, US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent signaled that he expects Japanese policymakers to take further steps to support the currency. Markets seem to take that message quite seriously, and the yen has strengthened against the dollar, while expectations have grown that the Bank of Japan could raise interest rates again in the near future. What has changed in the outlook for Japan and the yen over the past few weeks? And if policymakers continue to push for a stronger currency alongside higher interest rates, what implications could that have for investors both in Japan and globally?
I think this Japan story is actually quite interesting, not just for Japan, but it's more of a global story. I mentioned just before about the Federal Reserve, the US bond markets and the US federal rate hike in September. And I think a lot of central banks across the world are looking at the Federal Reserve. I mean, it is the global currency, still the dollar, and treasuries are still the global risk-free rate, and hoping that the Federal Reserve didn't have to hike interest rates, and that would then let all the other central banks breathe a little easier. Potentially, they wouldn't have to hike. The feed through here is that if the Federal Reserve hikes interest rate, that makes the demand for dollars stronger because you can go and invest your dollars at a higher level of yields in the US. So you generally see the dollar rally, which then puts downward pressure on other currencies, for example, the yen. Broadly, they don't want to do that because that puts downside growth pressure onto their local economy, doesn't it? So yeah, it's a difficult balancing act for global central banks. They generally don't want to hike interest rates if they don't have to, but the Federal Reserve, if they do hike interest rates in their meeting on the 16th of September, will be putting that pressure on other central banks across the globe. So the Bank of Japan, this is all happening in the middle of September. It's quite exciting, really, if you're into that sort of thing. The Bank of Japan's policy meeting announcements 2 days later on the 18th of September. The Bank of England is sandwiched in between on the 17th, and the ECB is a week before. It's a bit tricky for them because they won't know what the Federal Reserve is going to do, but they're on the 10th of September. But like I said, it's almost that the Fed will set off this domino potentially of interest rate hikes across the globe. That's what we could see in the next few weeks.
So you mentioned the ECB there. Sticking with Europe, France has increasingly become a focus. In a notable shift, French government borrowing costs have moved above those of Italy over much of the summer. So now markets are demanding a greater premium to hold French debt. Has something changed in the way that investors view sovereign risk in Europe? And if France is increasingly being seen as a potential source of concern, what does that mean for European markets and the wider investment outlook?
If you plot a graph of 10-year government bond yields from across the globe, all of them, apart from China really, but all seem to be going up. So it's not that France is necessarily being singled out as a country with a big deficit, which it does have, or a country with political question marks, again, which it does have. It's, you know, lots of other countries have that as well. But you're right to say that it's interesting that French government bond yields are creeping above Italian government bonds, you know. Backtrack 10 years ago when we had the European sovereign crisis and Italian bond yields were sky high, weren't they? They were like the poster child for that difficulty. Whereas France was seen as one of the safer European governments. So that's flipped around a bit. The focus in France, like you often get with these government bonds, is on the political timetable. And it's interesting that the political timetable in France is still next year. We've got the presidential election, the first round, 18th of April, and then the second round at the beginning of May. So we're still a few months away from that. We, as a multi-asset team, as a government bond team, we think that potentially those French government bond yields could continue to underperform as that timetable gets towards the presidential elections, because, you know, investors will generally worry a bit more when things come into the near term. But then, you know, you start to look at where these yields are, and they could be attractive. So, for example, the French government bond yields about 85 basis points, so 0.85% above German bond yield at the 10-year level. If you look at European credit, investment grade credit on an index level, that's roughly the same level as that entire credit. And that's made up of investment grade companies. So they're good companies, but they're still companies. They're not a government. So you get an extra yield. It's a little bit longer dated bonds. It's not quite light for light, but still, you know, that's your question mark. Those yields could potentially be interesting as we get towards the election.
You mentioned earlier on that we're going to have to talk about commodities before long. And I think we've hit that point. Oil prices have moved around pretty sharply over the past month, with volatility remaining elevated. But direction of travel, it seems, has perhaps started to shift. Analysts are now estimating that oil exports have recovered quite a bit from the disruption that we saw earlier in the summer. If that trend were to continue, lower energy prices could provide a welcome tailwind for households, help ease inflationary pressure, and of course reduce the need for tighter monetary policy. Ben, has the market become too pessimistic about the outlook for energy prices? And if oil prices do continue moving lower, what could that mean for the economy and central bank decisions over the coming months?
Oil is one of those things that I put in a bucket of really, really, really hard to forecast. And when we're talking about geopolitics, when we're talking about massive supply question marks, massive demand question marks, and also what we've seen during this Middle East crisis is unknown amount of storage of oil, particularly in China. We don't know how much storage they've got, and we don't know how much that's run down. I do think that has probably helped the price not accelerate too high. It's probably subdued the price moves that we've seen around the Middle East crisis, but we just don't know the size that we're talking about here. And the price of oil, it didn't go up as much as people feared at the beginning of the Middle East crisis, but it still is nearly $100 for Brent. So it's still very high. And if you look at longer dated futures, so if we're looking towards the end of this year, again, prices are pretty high. So people are having to pay a lot more than they did at the beginning of the year. And then if I want to get more pessimistic, I start looking outside of oil, and natural gas prices in Europe are elevated, and we're heading towards winter. Sorry to tell you that. After such a wonderful summer, we're heading towards winter in Europe as well, aren't we? Natural gas is very important at that side. And agricultural commodities as well. Those are high. There's issues around El Nino. There's supply concerns around the Ukraine-Russia conflict as well. So yeah, you were asking me an optimistic question. I'm shooting it down, unfortunately. I still think this is an issue. And this is what all the central banks are telling us, alongside the activity that we're seeing in AI. There is also these concerns about commodity prices impacting broader prices.
Well, you've given me my segue there for the next piece, which is about the AI story and its next step of evolution. NVIDIA, the big chip maker attached to that whole narrative, its latest results were remarkable, even by the company's own standards. What's striking, though, to many watching from the sidelines is that this doesn't just look like a simple earnings story anymore. The broader AI investment cycle continues to gather pace, demand remains robust, and there are not really many signs that spending on the underlying infrastructure is slowing from just these incredible levels. Has something changed in the scale of the AI opportunity that investors see out there? And if this investment cycle has further to run, where do you think the next opportunities might emerge beyond the companies that have so far led the story?
I think that's totally right. Earnings have been very, very strong. We've been, again, in the multi-asset portfolios, we've been generally overweight the technology sector for a while now because earnings are coming through. This is, in our opinion, different to the dot-com bubble bursting 25 years ago when there weren't earnings to back up those share price increases. Right now, the earnings are there. Now, the big question is how sustainable are those earnings? And I don't know the answer. We're going to have to see revenue associated with AI accelerate over time. But as I said, for now, that is happening. And at least the infrastructure behind the AI is definitely being built out. So companies that are building the chips and utilities that are providing electricity, they're doing very well. So you are definitely seeing earnings coming through. And we are still therefore overweight that equity sector. The place that I'm getting interested in, a little bit interested in, shall we say, is not necessarily a different sector. It's just a different asset class. If you look at some of the bonds that have been issued to fund this infrastructure build out, you're starting to see some rather high yields that, if you can invest in, if these companies don't go bankrupt, say, you've got investment grade companies with 30-year bond yields that are 7.5% yield. So you get 7.5% every year for nearly 30 years. That's quite a high, that is a high yield as long as you don't, as I say, have a bankruptcy. Now, that almost is the issue, isn't it? That the companies are going to have to generate revenue to justify those 7.5% to pay those yields. So at some point, I'm going to be more interested in locking down and buying those bonds than I might be from buying the equity. I'm not quite there yet, but that's something to have a look at.
Amazing year, it's really on that day. It'll be really interesting to see how that plays out over the longer term. Speaking of the longer term, we've got the UK budget coming up fairly soon and then the US midterms to watch out for. What other really big events are on your radar in the months ahead?
Well, I think that's right. It's the fiscal question mark. So it's the, as you say, it's what happens in the UK budget from a fiscal perspective. It's what happens in midterms from a fiscal perspective. Those are really the big questions of the next couple of months. Shorter term, though, I'm quite interested in what happens on the 9th of September, which is when Scott Bessent said he was going to increase the amount of buybacks on the long part of the US Treasury curve. He was getting upset, getting worried about how steep the US Treasury curve, basically how high 30-year bond yields are in the US. I mentioned those 30-year hyperscaler bond yields. Well, a lot of that is driven by the rise that we've seen in US bond yields. And he's said he wants to increase buybacks of those 30. He's also going to be issuing a lot of debt at the shorter end because, you know, the big fiscal deficit in the US. But I want to see if he's successful in that, in terms of getting that curve under control. So yeah, it's all about fiscal for me over the next couple of months. At the same time, we also need to see what the central banks are going to do. That middle of September, we need to come up with a name for that flurry of investment bank action we're going to see in a couple of weeks' time.
Yes, I'll put my thinking cap on. Next time we catch up, I'll give you some options. So we've covered absolutely loads, but as always, I'm sure I've missed something big and juicy out there. What is your number of the week for us?
So my number is going to be 6, because that is the number of basis points. 6 basis points are the range that we've seen for European credit spreads over the last, well, since May, so months now. It's been virtually unchanged, going from 76 basis points to 82 basis points. So remember, what I'm talking about here is the extra yield you get over government bonds. It's basically been stuck at 0.8% for a long period of time. And that is unusual. Normally you see, you know, credit spreads fluctuate with equity markets because people get bullish and they want to buy more, so spreads go down, or they get bearish and they want to sell more and spreads go up. But it's been flatlining despite quite a lot of headlines and despite what we've been talking about in terms of bond yields. And I actually think that's maybe the answer, that, you know, these rising bond, underlying government bond yields that we've been seeing across the globe, and as people worry about sticky inflation, as the Fed has talked about hiking interest rates, as the ECB has been hiking interest rates in Europe, that's been leading to these attractive bond yields for investors. Again, linking what I said about those hyperscaler bonds and those high yields of hyperscaler bonds. It's that underlying government bond yield increase that is attracting people to the credit markets. But still, very unusual to see that level of stability within credit corporate bonds. And it just shows you that there is still tremendous demand for these types of income asset class.
Well, thanks so much, Ben, for talking to me today. It was a great, incredibly wide-ranging conversation. I feel like I've learned a lot over the last 20, 25 minutes or so. To our listeners, I hope you can join us on the next episode of L&G Talks Asset Management.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of L&G's Asset Management Division, as at the date of publication. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and we're not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general market, economic or political issues, or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against L&G in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this podcast contains third-party information, the accuracy or completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information, not for distribution to any person in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulations. Copyright 2025. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Unless otherwise stated, references herein to L&G, we and us are meant to capture the global conglomerate that includes, in the European Economic Area, LGIM Managers Europe Limited, authorised and regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland as a UCITS management company pursuant to European Communities Undertaking for Collective Investment in Transferable Securities Regulations 2011 as amended, and as an Alternative Investment Fund Manager pursuant to the European Union Alternative Investment Fund Managers Regulations 2013 as amended. In the USA, Legal and General Investment Management America, Inc., a US SEC regulated investment advisor. In Japan, Legal and General Investment Management Japan, KK, a Japan FSA registered investment management company. In Hong Kong, issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, which is licensed by the Securities and Futures Commission. And in Singapore, issued by LGIM Singapore Pte Limited, company registration number 20223187 6W, which is regulated by the Monetary Authority of Singapore. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on LinkedIn or on our website.